paid my dues time after time. I've done my sentence but committed no crime, and bad mistakes I've made a few. I've had my shouts and kicks in my
This is Comics Therapy, episode 24. No reviews, just analysis. Up this week, two new comics from December 31st, 2013, or January 1st, 2014, depending on where you are in the world. Guardians of the Galaxy number 10 and Catalyst Comics number 7. As always, we have your nerd confessions in between segments. On the couch this week, we talked with artist Amy Reeder and writer Brandon Montclair, currently teaming up on Rocket Girl, published by Image Comics. Just a reminder, we don't do reviews, but we do talk a lot, so there might be spoilers from here on out.
Hi, Aaron. Hi, Andrea. Jason Sachs here, at Jason Sachs on the Twitter. Who are my favorite character teams in comics? See, it's easy to choose someone like the Fantastic Four, or Power Man and Iron Fist, or some of the characters from Valiant Comics, Archer and Armstrong, are a great example. But if you hear a pipe up the heavy metal behind me, my choice are Milk and Cheese, Jerry Parnas, Don Bad! Evan Dorkin's pair, Milk and Cheese, are the most wonderful, awesome, vicious, nasty milk products you could ever want. They are Jerry Parnas truly gone bad. Knives, guns, chains. I blame society. I blame the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. I blame Evan Dorkin for the brilliant, awesome insanity of Milk and Cheese. That's it. Out.
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so don't take anything we say seriously. The theme of the show this week is There's No I in Team. Comic books are full of teams, some more successful than others. You know me, I'm a sucker for the brooding guy in the leather jacket who usually isn't much of a team player, but I still do love a really great superhero team book, especially if that brooding guy is forced to play nice with others and reveal his secret heart of gold. But why is that? Why do we gravitate towards these extreme personalities in extreme situations? Because it's fun. And it's often a recipe for damn good storytelling.
Hi guys, it's Mike Garvey calling in again, also known as @avantgarde on Twitter. My confession for my favorite comic book team of all time would have to be, unsurprisingly, the Doom Patrol. I absolutely love the Doom Patrol. To me, they're the underdogs. They really are sort of the bottom of the heap when you look at all the other big superheroes in the DC universe, and they don't get no respect, damn it, but they still do the right thing. They get up and they will do whatever they can, however they can, to stop the weirdest enemies that threaten the world. Yeah, I discovered them probably around about the Rachel Polak era in Vertigo times. I thought they were cool, a little bit weird, but sort of moved on. And it was actually the Giffen and Clark run from 2009 that reignited something, and I thought, holy heck, that's right, these guys. So I went back and pretty much what every damn thing I could find that featured even one Doom Patrol member as a guest cast member in any book. So I basically have pretty much an entire shelf in my bookcase dedicated to Doom Patrol. Again, they just, you know, they'll do what's right however they can, even though, yeah, they're not the most well-known or well-liked superheroes. I guess I can identify with the underdog theme there. Anyway, thanks again for the show. Here's to a awesome 2014. Thanks, guys. Bye.
In between comic segments, your very own nerd confessions, celebrating the geeky things we all do, say, read, and enjoy. This week's prompt asks listeners to share their favorite character team-ups from any publisher. You can call, Skype, or email your confessions. All the details are on the website, comicstherapy.com. We're posting the weekly theme on the site, on Twitter, and on Facebook for your convenience, and the rest is up to you.
In between shows, you can find me on Twitter at Andrea Schock and Aaron at Aaron Myers, and the show account at Comics Therapy. Happy New Year, Aaron. How's it going?
So far, so good.
Yeah?
No catastrophes.
Excellent. Lots of fireworks, yeah. I hear.
Yep. Even the last couple nights, too. It'll be that way for a couple more nights. There are like 3 houses in the neighborhood that I know, and they ruin it for everyone. They like are stockpiling ammunition year-round, and any excuse, they'll fire it off.
That's weird to me still. I mean, when you were saying it the other day, I can sort of relate a little bit, but not to the extreme rural Oregon way that you were describing.
The laws are pretty lax. Like, there's not much enforcement, and it's legal to fire them off year-round. You can't do it, like, past 9 p.m., but when you've got little kids and dogs, even before 9 p.m., it's still annoying. It's just obnoxious. We're not rural. We're in a regular residential neighborhood. It's just a couple of, yahoos that don't know they're in a residential neighborhood.
Those yahoos, they ruin it for everybody.
You sure do. I know one of the houses is right behind us, and it's a couple of guys that are renting it. It's like 2 bros, and they love fireworks.
Have you ever considered just saying, like, hey, guys, that fireworks thing, can we, like, knock it off before...
I haven't. I know their neighbors have. They don't care. And the, law enforcement has been stripped down so much in Oregon. Like, there's no manpower to enforce it. Like, the jail lost, 9 beds, so they can't even really keep people who do, pretty serious crimes.
You're not like putting, fireworks setting off into that category, though, right?
When you keep getting woken up, or the child you just tried to spend an hour getting to sleep gets woken up by fireworks, that's tantamount to animal rape, in my book.
Wow. That was... Whoa. You just, took that and ran, way far with it. Maybe you should, I don't know, reach out to them in a pleasant way. Like, bake them cookies and say, could you guys maybe consider not doing this? Or, a gesture in a positive direction.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Okay.
Just gonna blow their cars up.
Huh. Well, happy New Year to you, too.
You don't come to Oregon and tell me how to live Oregon life. We deal with things in our own way.
Yes, you do.
You gotta fight fireworks with fire.
But you're not, and that's why you're miserable.
Well, yeah, I know, but, it's a new year.
Okay, and what does the new year bring for you, besides fire?
Comics?
Yeah, it's kind of a lot like last year.
Well, sure. Why stick with a good thing? Why change something that's working?
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. We got a Comic-Con next week.
Yes.
That's exciting.
Yes.
Although, I don't know what to expect.
I don't know what to expect either, and I'm hesitant to call it a con, I think.
Yes, or even an expo. I don't know what to expect, but I think it'll be fun.
Okay.
You don't think so?
I think it will be really interesting, and I'm hoping that it is fun.
It'll be really interesting for me, too, because it's more like, I think there's a keynote address that we'll be going to, I'm sure, and there's panels and things, but that seems more the focused with Image Expo, and not so much like walking through an artist alley or something.
Yeah, that's...
Even though I think there is part of that, it's more like a meet and greet?
I don't know.
Weird? I don't know.
I have reservations, but I think it's going to be fun.
Yeah. I mean, how bad could it be?
It's not going to be bad. I'm not saying it's going to be bad. I have no anxiety about this whatsoever. I'm not trying to make this into a thing with, capital letters. I'm just saying that there are other questions that I have about this particular event than I would if it was a different con. That's all.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. It will be different than what we've gone to in the past.
Who else is going to be there that we know?
I think Jason Sachs and Danny Elkin from Comics Bulletin will be there.
Excellent.
Those are the only two that I know for sure, or somewhat for sure, might be there. Okay. I don't know who else will be. Oh, Amir.
Yeah,
Amir is going. There's a couple other people. I think there'll be people there, but it's a small event, too.
Sure.
By con terms.
I'm also surprised that there are still tickets available. So I don't know if anybody's planning to make a last minute trip to the West Coast, because it's going to be fucking freezing over here on the East Coast right after I leave. I leave on Monday, Tuesday, high degree of one single degree. Whatever. So you can come to San Francisco where it is warmer and there's a little mini con, because there are tickets. Yeah. There are even VIP tickets still.
But it's a one-day thing. So I haven't looked at this. What's the difference between the regular ticket and the VIP ticket?
Stuff. I think you get a bag of stuff.
Oh. Do we get a bag of stuff because we got press tickets?
No. Are you kidding? No.
Well, that's crap. I want stuff.
You can buy stuff.
Yeah. The only thing that might be worth it, like the VIP tickets, if it's stuff like variant covers.
Right.
I know you don't care about this, but...
I don't.
Okay, so I'm thinking it from an economic standpoint. If I'm spending $200 to fly down...
Right.
You know, plus a couple hundred other dollars in expenses.
Okay. Are you buying me dinner or something? Where is this other expense?
No, I'm just going to stand on the con floor and just throw money and go, making it rain.
Okay.
So, if that's the case... So, say a VIP ticket... gets you, I don't know, say, certain variant cover or certain variant covers from an image series.
Mm-hmm.
I never would have thought about this in the past, but after Wizards World last year, I bought some Nowhere Man number one, exclusives, sold them for $135 a piece on eBay the next day.
Wow, you are such a pain in the ass when you talk like that.
Why?
Because it's so completely off my radar. I don't mean because I don't know that it happens. It's just...
Was usually off my radar, too. It's not something I would have thought of. I would buy variants or something just to keep, because I would want them. But now I'm thinking, if I go down there and say I bought two VIP tickets and got, so-and-so comic, if I waited a month, they're not going to be worth anything. If I put them up the day after, they'll sell for a lot of money.
I have mixed feelings about this, but you do what you need to do.
Well, I'm not made of money. It'd be nice to, get the trip paid for by just picking up some comics there,
That's fair. I agree.
So
I like the you buy me dinner part, though. That we should investigate that a little bit more.
Yeah, I'll look and see what, Taco Bell's or Wendy's are in the vicinity of there.
Thanks, dude.
Look, you can get anything off the dollar menu.
Aw, you're the sweetest.
Yep. Hey, I'm classy.
Anything else that we need to cover before, I don't know, we talk about comics?
Nope, we've got an exciting episode next week for people, so you could just skip over this one and just wait for next week.
No, that's not true. We've got good stuff this time, too.
Oh, okay.
Short stuff from us, but a really dynamic interview with Amy and Brandon. We had a lot of fun with that. But you're right, we should warn everybody that next week's episode is a little bit unconventional.
Except we will have a regularly scheduled interview like we normally do.
That's true.
Yes. So, half unconventional.
Half unconventional, half super awesome. And
the first half could be super awesome, too.
In a new and unique way. I don't know. Yeah. I haven't listened to it yet, so right. I can't speak for what it is that everybody else is going to listen to, but I can promise you that it's going to be different.
Let's give them the benefit of the doubt.
Okay. That's fine.
All right.
Speaking of benefit of the doubt... So you wanna do this inner child thing?
Sure, let's do it.
You've had 2 weeks off, my friend. So
yeah.
No pressure. Each week I give Aaron 90 seconds to talk about whatever he wants that we don't have time to discuss more deeply. 90 seconds, one book, one new comic from the past week that we are not analyzing further. Are you ready?
Yes.
Begin.
Let's talk about Twilight Zone number one.
Okay.
That came out this week. And it's only one issue in, but I was pleasantly surprised. I'm a pretty big Twilight Zone, the original series, the Rod Sterling series, fan. And more out of nostalgia, because I watched that a lot as a kid. There are definitely some classic episodes I love, but a lot of them, are kind of boring now as an adult.
Right.
But still, as a concept and as a, institution... Twilight Zone is very hard to make new stuff of, I think, and capture both the kind of classic feel and still make it modern? You know, it's like, that's a hard line to ride.
Is that what they did with this? I didn't pick it up. So, but there is a...
Yeah, it's a very Twilight Zone-y story.
But still modern.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. It's not classic, okay. You know, not set in the 50s.
30 seconds.
Okay. So, yeah, modern, good hook. Like, the art was pretty good, too. And, you know, I was impressed. I'm going to keep picking it up. And it'll be different stories. You know, they're probably one or two each. So it's kind of won't get boring, I hope, too. So we'll see. I don't know. I'm excited for it.
Okay.
How was that?
That was good. You had 5 seconds to spare.
Wow.
We made it. You did. Good job.
Thank you.
That doesn't ever happen, so.
Nope. I'm getting really good at this. You're going to have to figure out something else to throw me off my game.
Oh, I just knock it down to 45 seconds.
Okay. I'm going to keep until it'll be just 5 seconds. I just have to yell something about the comment.
It was good. It was great. Bye.
It's good. It sucked. I don't know.
Let's talk
about some things.
I should tell you that I've been mildly impressed. Like, don't let this go too much to your head. But you seem to have been keeping not entirely to your 30 books a week goal, but like you've been pretty reasonable about making choices, and I applaud you for that.
Well, that's good, because I have 37 on my list for next week.
I was just about to ask, knowing that next week is just ridiculous.
Well, that's not fair. I only had 18 this week, and I only had 5 the week before.
That's fine, but...
So, by that standard, you know, I could have 70 this week.
No.
No. It doesn't work that way. I can't bank.
You can't bank it, and you especially can't bank against weeks where there are literally not any more available.
I guess so.
Did you or did you not buy every single book available?
No, I didn't.
You didn't?
Even close. No.
Oh.
No, because there's just stuff like I'm not interested in.
Okay.
I don't buy all the comics. I just buy all the comics I'm interested in.
Right, but I mean these past 2 weeks when the numbers were so low, there were actually things that you...
Yeah, okay. There was stuff I'm just not reading, like I'm just not interested in, and I didn't really feel like there's so much stuff I was trying to catch up on anyway that I didn't feel like I wanted to try something new.
Okay, well then you can have my praise. Let's move on.
Okay.
Happy New Year, fellow Comics Therapy caller inners. Keith Silva here on the Wise Crack a Line. I'll call this my ROM Memorial Pick. If anyone tangentially connected with this show has a robot hard-on for ROM. As a young boy with the cheek of tan, my favorite duo was Cloak and Dagger. Don't ever let it be said old Jim Shooter couldn't pander, if anyone on Comics Therapy appreciates a good pandering, to Nancy Just Say No Reagan. The creation of Cloak and Dagger was one of the best Reagan-era knee-jerk reactions to scaring kids straight in the 80s. Dagger has to have one of the most ridiculous and gravity-defying costumes ever created. And Cloak has to rank as one of Marvel's most omnipotent, impotent characters in the multiverse. What's stopping him from covering any hero with his cloak and basically turning them into mush? Oh yeah, Dagger. Heart wants what the heart wants. Now, if you were a straight male in the 80s and Dagger didn't make you feel all squishy like the possibility of a utopian society on some far-flung planet, Galador, then you weren't spending enough time with Ty and Tandy. Tandy. Even her name is ridiculous. Remember, you drug fiends and prescription pill poppers, don't get high on your own supply of Cloak and Dagger comics. It could kill you.
Our first book this week is Guardians of the Galaxy number 10, written by Brian Michael Bendis and drawn by Keith McGuire, with colors by Justin Ponzer, and lettering by Corey Pellet.
Pettit?
Right? Pettit?
That's a T.
Guardian.
Not
whatever.
An L.
I don't care.
Okay.
Guardians is published by Marvel Comics.
Okay. Here's the recap from this issue. The hunter warrior Angela has come to this galaxy because of a time-space continuum accident. She's trying to figure out her place in the galaxy. Thanos' army came very close to taking the Earth, but the Guardians helped save the planet. The Mad Titan has disappeared. So, some other things to be aware of. This is obviously taking place after Infinity, and the Guardians played a role in that event, as you probably know. Previously, Iron Man was also kicking around with them, except when he wasn't, but he's now pretty officially back with the Avengers after Infinity. This issue was primarily an opportunity to give Angela and Gamora some ass-kicking time together.
Yep.
Good stuff.
How do you feel? Did you ever read Spawn in the 90s?
I read bits and pieces, but by no means did I read the entire run, or am I able to talk like coherently about it at all.
Okay, well, so you weren't really familiar with like Angela or anything?
Not in the way that some people were. Although I have to say, there were quite a few like of our friends who were completely willing to admit that they had no idea who she was, and I thought that was pretty excellent.
I knew who she was because I was obsessed with Spawn, at least like the first 25 issues.
Sure.
Like those were golden age
hands
comics.
Up, who is surprised that you were obsessed with Spawn?
Well, Spawn was amazing in the 90s. That was like I don't care who, whatever people want to like go back and retcon how they think about comics, you know, from then. But if you were between 13 and 17 in those kind of those years, that stuff was awesome.
And male.
Yeah, right. Sure.
Yeah.
No, yeah, probably.
Yep. Just go with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially like a character like Angela or something like that. It's like so ridiculously, you know,
right.
Scantily clad warrior woman
right.
kind of thing. But still, like, McFarlane's art, you could say maybe it doesn't work in these days, but he's still so talented, and that stuff was just like so revolutionary,
oh,
at least for me.
And very influential and deserves all of the accolades that it has been given. But
and it's almost unreadable now. Like when I go back and it's like, but it wasn't really written for 35-year-old me, you know? it was written for 15-year-old me.
Right.
Like I loved it. Or 14 or whatever.
So you, seriously, a lot of our friends were like, I don't know who she is, but okay, that's cool. And I'm only throwing that out there because it's refreshing when people who read a lot of comics are able to say, like, I got nothing. I don't know who this is. I don't know why we care, but I'm interested. So
And no one should care, really, other than Neil Gaiman, Marvel Comics, and Todd McFarlane.
Right.
Because it's all stems out of lawsuits. Did you know that part
of it? I know a little bit. I mean, but only because I went back and looked it up. It's not something
right.
That
so, like, because Neil Gaiman and Tom McFarlane were suing each other for a decade over rights to these characters, and Neil Gaiman won. And so, it's like putting her in the Marvel Universe is sort of this middle finger to Tom McFarlane, who, you know, famously put his middle finger up to Marvel in the 90s and started, you know, Image Comics with those other guys.
Right. So, back to the story.
But it does have something to do with the story because you're injecting a character from an alternate reality, quote unquote. Into the Marvel Universe, quote unquote, but it's all this kind of tongue in cheek in a way.
Is it? Because there's a very, very high likelihood of this getting very tedious very fast.
Yeah. I mean, it's still compelling. I think Bendis is writing it kind of interesting now.
Yeah, I'm
like,
enjoying it.
It was super heavy handed at the end of Age of Ultron, but.
No.
Yeah. And it's like supposed to be this huge dramatic thing. It's like, oh, this is how it all ends. And everyone's like, what? Who cares?
Right.
But I would still say what they've done with it since then, you know, the ramifications into Infinity and Inhumanity and even now into Guardians of the Galaxy, which will go into their movie and everything else, are like, it's pretty kind of interesting.
Do you think that? Do you think it's that there are some like direct storytelling implications for the movie?
Yes. I would say it probably highly likely you would see Angela in the Guardians of the Galaxy movie.
Wow. Okay.
Like I don't know. Maybe not, but it wouldn't surprise me at all.
I'll be honest, I hadn't thought of that at all.
Well, you got to think of it from a marketing standpoint. Like,
I think of a lot of stuff from a marketing standpoint, and that was one that I hadn't considered.
So you're selling Rocket Raccoon as a kind of cool, funny, you know, like comic relief guy, right?
Right.
So you can sell your Rocket Raccoon plushies and whatever.
Right.
And then you've got Groot who says, I am Groot. And then there's going to be all the Hot Topic t-shirts that say, I am Groot and everything else. And
right.
Then you've got Gamora who's a green warrior. Kind of cool, kind of hot. You know, maybe that's good for the kids.
I don't really understand the kind of qualifiers that you're putting on either of those, but okay.
Well, because you need a hot white girl to sell, you know, really sell it in a bikini with a sword.
She's not white.
Nah, she's pretty white.
She's not even played by a white actress.
Not Gamora, Angela.
I was talking about Gamora.
Right, that's why I'm skipping over her, though. I'm saying
she's green,
she's an alien, she's a warrior. She's sexy in that, like, She-Hulk kind of way.
Yeah, She-Hulk is fucking awesome. What is your problem?
Because I'm talking, well, what are you going to sell to the, you know, 13 to 35-year-old boys?
I don't know. I am not that demographic, and so I...
Wait, you're going to sell Angela to them.
Okay. I don't agree.
You don't have to.
It's awfully early for this kind of speculation, but I think you're wrong.
I don't know. Maybe. We'll see.
Okay. Maybe in part two or something. It just seems...
Maybe. I mean, it seems really arbitrary. Weird. Sure, but everything's arbitrary in comics if you break it down.
But not in the movies. The movies are extremely well planned.
Okay, but at the same time, Marvel is tying... Nobody's going to find this discussion interesting. But at the same time, the comics now parallel, at least somewhat, the way the movies will go, because they want to tie them in for sales. Okay. So it doesn't make sense to put Angela in the Guardians of the Galaxy and not have her be part of the movie.
Okay. When does Guardians come out?
Next year. End of this year, I think.
Okay. God, that's a long time to wait to find out that you're wrong. I enjoyed this issue. I thought that the banter between Gamora and Angela was sort of interesting. I mean, like, badass chick banter can be a thing in and of itself. And
sure, but it has to be done well. Was this done well? Otherwise it's a dude writing chick's banter.
Well, yes, it is. And in fact, it gets like very dude writing when they come back and like, isn't it? It's Quill who says like, oh, this is your version of a spa day. Ha ha ha. I mean, mm-hmm. There were some very easy lines that Bendis used in this particular issue, but you know, mm-hmm. still it was fun. I like this book. I don't think a lot about this book in terms of heavy implications for like the rest of what's happening, because I don't know. I guess I'm bad about kind of keeping it within the bigger picture. I tend to view this series of events and these characters as somewhat isolated from the rest of the titles.
Yeah, but they're not.
And, I know, yeah. But I'm saying that's like on me. That is my obstacle that I have when reading this that perhaps actually lets me enjoy it more.
Right.
Well, I did want to talk about them as a team.
Okay.
Because, you know, that's the whole fucking point of this particular episode, dear Aaron.
All right, whatever.
I think that their shtick is unique. So, like, and they actually deal with that in the past couple of issues in terms of incorporating Angela, if they sort of are. You know, they represent these kind of unique individuals in the galaxy, one of a kind, if you will, and yet when they come together, they're very cohesive, and they have, like, these strengths and this camaraderie in a way that, yes, it's fairly, like, it's a fairly typical setup, but I think it's actually been done pretty well. I think that that's why people, like, have a lot of love for the Guardians of the Galaxy. Because they come together in a way that, you know, showcases the various personalities and strengths and weaknesses with humor, which is important. And, like, that's a thing. That works really well.
Okay. That's fine. I think they're an okay team. I think sometimes the banter between them is pretty overly done. It sort of is feels like the mandate, like you see in Nova somewhat. You know, I'm stuttering because I don't want to make it sound like I like it less than I do, but sort of that kind of nothing can touch us, you know, we're so badass.
Yeah.
Banter.
I guess I don't have a problem with that with some superhero books because like nothing does touch them. I mean,
right, but isn't that boring? I like the Avengers because stuff has been happening to people. Like, obviously, it doesn't have long-term ramifications, but you still felt like there's intensity to it. Like,
okay, well,
that would be my one complaint with the Guardians. Like, there's never been much intensity with what's been going on.
Well, then contrast that with like Avengers and X-Men, just in terms of the three teams that Marvel has right now that are getting the attention. And when the Guardians movie was announced, a lot of people were like, what? Why them? Right? So why them?
Because it ties... Well, this goes back to tie-ins. So you have a Guardians of the Galaxy movie, then you have Avengers 2, which is going to have Thanos in it, which ties into what's going to ever happen in Guardians of the Galaxy. Then you've got, like, Age of Ultron stuff happening with Iron Man, the next Iron Man, I guess. And, you know, they all kind of will build on these things. And I guess, you know, eventually maybe in 2018 or something, you'll have this big sort of Infinity Gauntlet thing that'll happen. You know, it all builds towards that. Well, we should probably move on to our next book.
Yeah, yes, absolutely.
It's going to be
an amazingly awkward transition, and that's fine.
Yes, I mean, I guess we could let everyone know that somebody decided to start taking a shower in the room you were recording in, and it sounded like somebody was banging on the desk with drums, so we had to stop recording.
That makes it sound extra awkward, so thanks for that.
Yeah, well, I don't know what you East Coasters do.
I can't wait to go home. I can't wait to go home. I can't wait to go home. Our next book. Go for it.
Hi, guys. This is Tom Arnett, also known as T-Porter10 on Twitter, calling in about the favorite team. It's going to have to be either the X-Men drawn during the Paul Smith era or A Blast from the Past, the Micronauts. That team always has a soft spot in my heart. Thanks, guys. Great show.
Our second book is Catalyst Comics number 7, written by Joe Casey, with art by Ulysses Farinas, Paul Mayberry, and Dan McDade, and coloring by Brad Simpson, lettering by Russ Wooten, and the cover is by Raphael Grandpa. Catalyst Comics is published by Dark Horse Comics.
Okay, from the solicit, the Agents of Change take the lead in this action-packed issue. Bear witness as Elvis, Wolf Hunter, and the crew make a chilling discovery. Grace races to head off an invasion, and Frank puts down his peace pipe to tap a keg of wass. So Catalyst Comics is like an anthology by a single author. It's a way of exploring multiple stories set within a single superhero universe. Sometimes the stories overlap and intersect in significant ways, and sometimes they don't. Two of the stories in each issue focus on a singular hero, Amazing Grace and Frank Wells, who each played a part privately publicly, respectively, in stopping the end of the world. And the other story revolves around the various members of the Agents of Change. Grace and Frank aren't on a team, per se, though they do have allies, and the Agents of Change have crazy problems of their own.
So you just read basically all the current issues kind of all at once, right?
I did, in fact, read all of the current issues all at once.
And I wonder how that read compared to like how I've been reading it, you know, month to month, where there's a lot going on here. And I'll be honest, it's like it's kind of hard for me to remember sometimes like what was happening when I left off. And there's recaps and things. So I really find the Frank stories and the Amazing Grace stories to be the strongest. Like the Agents of Change one is so wild, and there's so much like going on that I find that one the hardest one to pick back up month to month.
So I've been thinking about this since you pointed it out last week about the different ways that you and I read. I guess I think that it's actually makes things easier for me when I catch up on several issues at once. And in this particular case, when you have multiple stories and so many characters to follow, I agree. Like, I can't imagine for you, because you have so many other books that you're reading every month, how you stay on top of it. Because there's a lot of there's a lot of big, bold action, but there's also a lot of subtle development in terms of how the stories actually interact with one another,
yeah,
and what's happening with the individual characters, especially in the Agents of Change.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Maybe that's why it's hard for me to remember with that one.
I think it's great. I really, really enjoyed it. I think the introspection and the kind of problems and self-discovery that the individual heroes are going through is a great investigation of that, of that concept of superheroes with issues is always something that is appealing to me. So I enjoyed this. I hadn't looked at it before. I wasn't super familiar with it. It's been recommended to me by a couple of people, but it just wasn't really something that I found myself gravitating towards. But in this case, I enjoyed the hell out of it. I read the first couple and then took a little bit of a break. And then I read the last, I guess, four issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in terms of an ensemble, there's something really interesting about dividing the story the way that Joe Casey does, because it really does kind of all work together in this kind of singular universe, but we still get a lot of individual drama and strife, and I kind of get off on that. And so when you talk about a team that doesn't really work super well as a team, there's just a lot of potential for story from that interpersonal conflict to balance the kind of external conflict that the superheroes in general have to battle. So it's a nice flip on that convention.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. And it's a different universe than what we're used to too. So it's kind of pretty wide open to explore. I mean, there's limitations on that. It probably needs to reflect what the 90s run of this did, but it's kind of deviated a lot even from that. You know, it's very kind of cerebral and surrealistic, all the stories.
It is. There are a couple of moments where the narration, I mean, it's very tongue-in-cheek, and I don't know enough about Joe Casey as a writer, but he clearly has a lot of love for musical theater, because holy cats are his introductions peppered with references to everybody from Sondheim to Cole Porter to, the movie Grease. Are you kidding? That's fairly unusual in comics, and I always notice it. So anybody who thinks that this isn't that kind of book, you need to look a little closer, because there's something for everybody.
Oh, yeah, for sure. But it's also the same kind of thing. And it's also the same kind of thing that maybe not all three stories are for everybody. So that's why it's kind of a hard thing to say, everyone has to read this. But I think if you like team and superhero stories that aren't what you would normally be reading, it's kind of a good, I guess I would say it's a superhero stories and a team superhero story for people that don't like superhero stories.
I guess I would put it in the same vein as Copra.
Sure. Yeah, I would say it's even more surreal than that, though.
Yeah, but it is certainly taking, the commentary is, it's taking a more negative approach to the idea of what it means to be a hero and kind of the trials and tribulations of that role than a more mainstream superhero book might. And especially with Frank, the soul searching and the response that he was expecting versus the reality of the situation after he kind of saves the world, and his self-discovery process between then and now,
is much more esoteric than you typically get a chance to see with a hero of any type.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think that's cool.
Mm-hmm. That is a good, I guess that's a good way of explaining it, because I like superhero stories too, and I still like this. It's just it's more of an exploration, I guess, of those kind of stories.
Yeah, and when you have a flawed character in that role, like with that power, I guess in a more academic way, like, it does make it a little bit more interesting, because they have internal obstacles to overcome. And we've talked about that over and over again. That's what drew us to the struggle in Buzzkill, for example. And that's why, you know, a lot of the heroes, the like flawed heroes or kind of the tragic archetypical characters, have this major flaw. Like, that's why you do that, because otherwise they're too perfect and it's not as interesting.
Yep. It's true.
So but in the case of the Agents of Change, where they're working together, sort of, not really,
mm-hmm.
the like very visual and like obvious references to like group therapy and like working together as a group and working through their problems as a group. I mean, I think it's very amusing, but it's also like, it, you know, it's actually very honest talking about like trying to get the band back together and what that actually means with mm-hmm. these personalities. It's good storytelling.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you liked it. I'm glad you got to kind of read it up to what it's at now too, because I think you get a fuller experience. This is one of those, not trade books, but it's kind of a good large consumption book, I think.
Yeah. Certainly when you're bouncing back and forth, I think it sounds like it was more of a challenge, or is more of a challenge, to track all of the various threads of the stories month to month, but over a week or so, it wasn't bad at all.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, do you want to, I don't have a good transition for this. I was going to say talk to some people that have a good, are easy to track, but that doesn't work.
No. Dude, the entire thing, like, just keep pushing the team stuff, right?
Okay.
We talked about teams.
Sure.
Everybody
so
called in about teams.
We can say, let's talk to a good team of creators.
Yeah.
We did it. High five. Way to go, team.
Sloppy. Yep. Absolutely sloppy, Myers.
I know. Well, let's talk to Amy Reeder and Brandon Montclair.
Hello. I just wanted to get involved in this conversation. One of my favorite team-ups is Batman Superman. I think that they are the perfect comparison to each other. Superman is a big, bright god, all liked, and Batman is the dark, gritty, underworld side of the team. It's almost like a split personality between them both. My other team is Dick Grayson Batman and Damian Wayne Robin. I think everyone is so used to Batman being the serious side of the team, but when Dick took over Batman, he became happy, smiley, and Damian became the dark side. It was such a great switch from the usual comparison between Batman and Robin. Thanks, Jason Webb.
This week on The Couch, we welcome another great team, artist Amy Reeder and writer Brandon Montclair, creators of Rocket Girl, published by Image Comics. Brandon and Amy also collaborated on the well-received one-shot Halloween Eve, published last year by Image. They've been working together for a number of years, but have really hit their stride as a creative pair with Rocket Girl, the third issue of which is out this week. We talked about our anticipation and excitement of the series back in episode 17. Thanks for hanging out with us, guys.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's going to be fun.
Yeah.
We try. I want to get a sense of you both individually as well as a team. Amy, your first published work was the manga Fool's Gold, which you wrote and drew. And we're going to talk more about that in a bit. And then you went on to draw Madame Xanadu for Vertigo, right? Okay. So it sounds like a very easy transition when I say it like that. Oh, just one to another, no big deal. But
up and did it.
Can you talk about how one led to the other? I mean, is that actually the case?
Yeah, kind of is, yeah. Because I was actually in the middle of working on Fool's Gold when the Madame Xanadu possibility came up. But the thing that actually does kind of tie it all together is Brandon over here. Because he was an editor at Tokyopop for a little while. And during that time, he wasn't my editor, but he was telling people that they should really hire me right before he left. And sure enough, they did finally get me a 3-volume graphic novel deal, which was crazy. So yeah, I was working on that, and then he went over to DC working under Bob Schreck. And I guess had been thinking when he gets an opportunity, it would be great to hire me over there. So when they moved over to Vertigo, they felt like I was a much better fit there than maybe like the DCU and stuff. And basically like created a situation that I could, you know, be best shown, you know, like that he, like they tried to figure out a character that already existed, right, in the DCU.
Yeah, we were new to Vertigo at the time, so yeah. Part of the idea was that let's do what one of the, it wasn't a mandate, but a, you know, a suggestion.
Let's do the recipe for success.
Well, no, it was, we haven't done a kind of adult DCU character in a long time, so let's do a little more of that now that you're, you know, that now that Schreck and I were in Vertigo.
Yeah.
So, you know, so we did the Madam Sound of, went up, like Haunted Tank came out of that kind of, like, let's take some old character, which is what Vertigo started as, right?
Yeah. Right, yeah.
I guess they hadn't done it with anything new for a while, so, and before it was, I mean, we've said this before, so it's not a secret, but before it was even Madam Xanadu, we were trying to do Amethyst, and that just never worked out. Yeah.
Amethyst was proposed as a Vertigo book?
Yeah, with Amy doing, and it, you know, it kind of went pretty far up the flagpole until, you know, they jumped ship.
Well, it was then. Karen Berger's baby, right?
Back, it was her. It was one of the first books she edited, right?
Yeah,
you know,
so I
back
think,
in the '80s.
Yeah, so I think she was a little. She wasn't sure that she could part with it yet, but yeah. So I don't know. I'm Brandon. You know, Bob Schreck is very close to Matt Wagner, and somehow they managed to get him on board. And once that was the case, then it was just easy breezy. And at that point, like I'd done 2 volumes of. Fool's Gold was about to finish my second one and knew that I wouldn't be able to do the third one. So, yeah, I just kind of, like, skipped on over there. I mean, for the most part, I've just been doing long-term projects, which I feel really lucky for.
Yeah, it's going to be nice to have those kind of long runs that you could work on and really get tied to a, you know, to a story and characters.
It doesn't make for a good story for us, though. You should, like, add some more... Drama,
I know about like difficulties and stuff.
Right.
Like
yeah.
Most of my difficulties have been like just dealing with stress, you know. But
that's a, that's
I feel
legit.
Like I'm never lucky. So yeah,
that's awesome. Well, okay. So speaking of transitions, which yours were very smooth, Brandon, mm-hmm. you've moved more and more towards writing from the editing side over the past several years, which is super exciting and I'm sure equally non-stressful, right? So we're going to get deeper into that in a bit, but can you address at the forefront, like how is your experience as an editor, how has that led to writing opportunities and like how did those two go together?
You know, becoming an editor was much stranger than becoming a writer because I hadn't had any experience in publishing at all. I owned a comic shop. I worked in a comic shop, where I was part owner, since I was a teenager, you know, and, it was cool. I say this a lot. It was cool up until, you know, when you're 19, it's really cool to own your own comic shop. At 25, it gets a little bit, you know, I don't know if I want to do this with the rest of my life. So I wound up relocating to California for a couple of years with my wife, and went back to school and kind of on a lark, just started working part time. There was Tokyo Pop and Top Cow were both kind of hiring. And I just, at the time, Tokyo Pop was doing like more interesting stuff and they were kind of, you know, just, you know, doing more odds and ends. So working there was really just bizarre because I had no experience, but nobody else at Tokyo Pop had experience except for one or two other people. And at least I knew comics, whereas a lot of those people, they came from the magazine and book world.
Yeah, they didn't know anything.
Yeah. So then I worked at Tokyo Pop for a little bit and then moved back home to New York and got a job at DC.
Was that kind of around the same time like Brandon Graham was doing some stuff through them? And
I was only working on what they called it 10 different things, but it was basically their original manga line, right? Where it wasn't, because Tokyo Pop was more well known for their translations and stuff. And I didn't work on too many of those. But then, like I said, you know, working for DC kind of left Tokyo Pop at the right time. But then in DC, the reason I got into writing, it was never like a long-term goal. It is for some people, which is perfectly fine. But I loved editing. But you know, DC was kind of just, I was sitting there for a long time. It's a slow place to be sometimes, but more than that, my daughter was born, you know, my first child and only child so far. Mm-hmm. So my wife has a flexible schedule. She's a professor. She just got tenure this year, but, you know, she was tenure track at the time and had a pretty flexible schedule and but also rather stable. So her maternity leave was running out, and I was like, I can kind of leave DC now and maybe try to pick up some writing work here and there. I had written one book, and a few short things for Tokyo Pop before working at DC. A little bit of writing experience also.
I'm kind of curious about that. When somebody's an editor for a while and then makes that transition to really focusing on writing, does the editing and editing other people's writing help, help build your voice as a writer, or do you find it influenced it in ways you wish it hadn't? Like, I'm kind of curious, you know, like how artists will talk about how they sometimes getting too much into other artists' work can affect, you know, their art.
Yeah,
I'm curious if that happens with writing too.
Not with me. I understand what you're saying though, and can see it happening. I had a very practical approach, so, you know, that's probably why I was an editor and you know, maybe a decent editor. So to be able to, like I said, those skills to translate or it was, you know, to me, it wasn't, there was no conflict of, or, you know, anxiety of influence, right? It was, I worked on some great stuff. So I would read Frank Miller scripts, or I'd read Grant Morrison scripts, or I'd read Brian Azzarello scripts, and they're all very different. And they're all incredibly influential. But, you know, to me, it was more like, I wasn't mystified by anything. I think a lot of people who want to break into any aspect of comics are kind of mystified by how does somebody do this? Right. And I guess, you know, I didn't have to worry about that because I had already been in it for so long. So like I said, they were very influential, but again, not in voice, you know, but, you know, 'cause my voice kind of just, you know, it develops, I guess, a little bit from everything. So no one I ever felt was kind of dominant. See, but it comes from movies. It comes from listening to radio. It comes from definitely from comic books. But I don't think editing comic books was much different for me than maybe reading comic books is for a lot of writers.
Uh-huh.
But it was so much more intense. It was 40 hours plus a week. So you learned a lot. If anything I learned, it's actually dealing with artists and writers and colorists and publishing, and maybe, like I said, putting some of that into play more than just putting words on a page.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so, but the actual structure of being able to publish and produce.
Kind of, yeah, but also just kind of being able to work with people, you know? I haven't written a ton of stuff since leaving DC, but I've worked with Amy Reeder and Shane Davis and Michael Kaluta and Simon Bisley, you know what I mean? And then a few other friends, but they're big names, right?
Right, so, yeah.
Well, I think I kind of think that you're somewhat influenced from being an editor because, kind of your big MO is that you write differently depending on the artist who is working with you. And that's kind of a very collaborative effort. I mean,
right.
That's sort of what editors have to do.
Oh, yeah,
catering.
Very influential, but not, like I said, not having access to the Frank Miller script made me write like Frank Miller.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But having some flexibility in doing it, you know.
It's got, because I'm also thinking of this from an outside view, but what I've heard is people's approach to how their scripts look and, you know, how they might present it to artists is vastly different. So it's got to be kind of a neat window to be able to see all these writers who are, you know, very well established and, you know, not rookies to writing comics, how they present a script to an artist. And
right.
And being able to kind of pick and choose, like, well, I'm not going to do this because this doesn't work for the how I want to present a story. But you kind of getting to shape that, not through like trials by fire, you know, failures like for years and years, but seeing how other people do it and then kind of deciding what your approach is going to be.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't mean to sound piecemeal because it's never felt like I've just kind of cobbled it together. It's very natural. It's very much my process. So, but it really is like, oh, you know, Grant Morrison is, I write a script the most like Grant Morrison, but my finished product is probably the least like Grant Morrison. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
It's,
uh-huh.
So it's, Yeah, it's definitely all of that. And I find it interesting. I mean, I love reading scripts, you know. I love every part of editing. Talking to colorists, all that other stuff.
Well, kind of a question maybe for both of you. That transition from mainstream kind of books, you know, DC, Marvel books, to doing creator-owned works, is that a natural progression? Or is it a natural progression for creators, especially these days? Or was it for you?
Well, it is for me for sure, because part of the reason why I did the superhero stuff, I mean, I enjoyed it and stuff, but my ultimate goal was always to do the creator own sort of thing. So in that sense, it felt really natural. To me, it's a lot easier to come up with something on your own than to, you know, have your take on an established character as well. But I think a lot of I do think that that's the general goal these days with artists and writers. Maybe not for everybody. Some people, like, they just, their whole lives have just really been wanting to draw the Hulk, you know. But I would say I would think that the majority, or at least half of artists, want to make their own creations. So it's good that I don't know that it was really a natural way that it came about. I think it's more because the DC Marvel model has become less stable. So it's kind of forced people to do what they've been wanting to do all the time. Because before it was sort of made them uncomfortable and they didn't want the instability. But now there's no reason why not to. So.
Yeah, it's like, you know, working at Marvel and DC used to be, you know, Amy says people grow up wanting to do that stuff. But I think for a lot of artists and writers, to become professional, you kind of grow past that. And it's great to work on Batman or Superman or anything else. But, you know, you're a creator, right? So you want your own thing. And you also maybe want the accolades or the financial rewards of having something that's successfully creator-owned. But you can never really make enough money doing it. Right. But I think, you know, if you look at rates for the top guys at Marvel and DC, they still go up somewhat. But rates for even like what you would call A talent or B talent, good talent, have kind of stayed the same for 20 years. You know what I mean? And that's not people, you know, point to say corporate greed. But now the numbers have also kind of declined and prices have gone up and all this other stuff. So I don't think Marvel and DC, you know, have been able to really, like I said, compete with creator owned stuff. So now that creator owned stuff, you know, now that Marvel and DC kind of stood still a little bit and creator owned have caught up, a lot of people have the option to leave Marvel or DC and make almost as much, you know, at worst. And if something catches, you know, lucky break, you're going to make a lot more money. Yeah. So it's, then you add in Kickstarter, which we've been successful with, but other things too, or somebody who can. You know, it's one thing, you know, it'd be great if they made Rocket Girl into a movie, but hey, even if they just pick up an option, that makes it a little bit more money.
Yeah.
That you do it. And people have kind of, you know, certainly for artists, there's no longer the expectation of working monthly anymore. So if you're going to be putting out 6 issues a year, you know, again, you can support, you might as well do your own thing and make your own book. And if you sell, I think this is Brubaker who did the math, right? He said, well, I know that if I can sell 17,000 copies at Image, I'll make more than selling than I do on Captain America. You know what I mean? So it's a goal.
Yeah, that he'll be able to pay all of the people. Creative like team. It would all be divided into the creative team, and they'd earn just as much.
Right. So and that's you know, 17,000 isn't an easy number, but it's certainly a doable number for Ed Brubaker. And I mean, you talk about all the time. Sean Murphy was just you know, saying, oh, if we did the Wake at Image instead of Vertigo, I would have made 3 times as much money just on page rates. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so, but at the same time too, they've established names by doing mainstream works too.
Oh no, absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's certainly right. I don't know. It's funny because people go to Image and then they get snapped up by Marvel and DC, right? Mm-hmm. But then they're going back to Image now anyway. So it's like, you know, is there going to be a generation of people who just start working for Image and stay there? I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I'm curious about, especially the people in their kind of early 20s now, you know, who have grown up with a different generation of comic books and different financial models. Well, we could talk about the industry all day, but I kind of have and maybe we will, but I have a question more about your work process, like day by day. You know, You said it's a pretty traditional division of labor on Rocket Girl in terms of scripting and art. So Brandon, what's a typical writing day for you look like? And Amy, what's a typical drawing day look like for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's nothing, nothing special, but I'm usually doing one thing. So I'm either breaking down a story for the future or I'm writing, you know, as far as Rocket Girl. And if I'm not doing anything of that, maybe I'm pitching something else and working on developing a series. So it's changed a lot. The reason I have some more time now is that my daughter just started preschool. So she has a half a day of school. And again, I could drop her off, go to the library while she's in school and do like a 4-hour chunk, which is about all I can be productive. And then I need a couple of hours break and then come back and write again. But getting a more fixed schedule is something I'm kind of just now settling into.
Just because as a natural transition with your daughter's schedule, you mean?
Having more opportunities to do stuff, right? I can't remember. You know, there's some, one of the, you know, funny laws that they call is like, you know, as much time as you give me to do it, that's how long it'll take. And a lot of people in comics suffer from that, where it's like, well, I have to draw one page, but I have a week to do it. Well, then they'll take all week doing it, you know?
Right.
Well, you almost feel like a jerk if you do it really fast.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know about that. But,
I do.
But it's a step at a time. And again, I work pretty traditionally, even though I don't have an editor. I'll, I'll break it down page by page. So 20 pages, what's going to go on each page? Do a first by scene, you know, 5 scenes in the book here, the 5 scenes, then here's what's going to happen on every page. And then I write, and I sometimes write out scenes out of order, but I'll write a whole scene at a time. And then, you know, oftentimes I'll go back and rework it, because dialogue is the hardest thing for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm never really, and I write very slowly because I edit while I'm writing, you know? So it's not like, okay, Oh, here's a draft, let me go back and do it. I kind of spend a long time working on one line, and then I realize I do 2 pages, and I just reused half those same words because I've been working a day on this 2-page scene, and it's not different enough because, you know, I don't move quick enough, so I don't remember that I maybe had just done something or have to move it. So then that gets me in trouble sometimes, but, you know, I try to keep up.
I keep watch.
So what about you, Amy? How about, what's a typical drawing day look like?
Since I'm doing a lot of the other chores too, it kind of depends. I mean, right now I'm doing pencils and inks, which is what I'm normally doing. It's about like at least half of the time, maybe 3/4 of the time, of my work is just penciling and inking, which I kind of do simultaneously. But then for like a week's time, I do thumbnails for the issue. And for a week's time, I color. And then for a couple days, I letter and finalize everything. So, I don't know. The thumbnails are super hard and I can't focus. And I want to slack off during that period of time. So I go out to cafes and I work there because... Yeah. That's what I've learned is the best way to do it. Cause...
Yeah, and here's the interactive process on thumbnails, right? So Amy reads the script and is very nice and said, "This is so great. It's going to be awesome. This is fantastic." And
uh-oh.
Then the next day she's going to start breaking down. Then she's calling me up and yelling, "How can I put this on a page?"
Whatever.
And then it works out and then it's all good at the end. No, I mean, you know, it's sometimes...
Well, it's hard to tell until I start making it work.
Then you like it again. Right.
So, yeah.
We're both very pleased always with the final product, which maybe is...
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if it's egotistical or if we're just good or I don't know. It's just, hey, I read Rocket Girl, and I'm very worried, you know, because like, oh, I haven't read it in a while, but here's the draft and it's got to be, you know, go to the printer. And then I read it and say, wow, this is the best comic I ever read. And
That's good. I think that's probably speaks more about a healthy emotional state too, whereas somebody who would look at their work and go like, "Oh my God, how did we publish this?" You know, and so always tearing themselves apart.
I always feel bad for artists, but so many more
people are that way. They're like, "Well, maybe I'm just totally delusional that it's like not that." You know what I mean?
Because
so many more people are hard on themselves. But Amy and I just by coincidence both look at it and it's like, "Wow, this is like the greatest." this thing. Like,
yeah, we both like kind of get both a high off of the finished product.
Off of our own work, right?
Yeah. It's I encourage that though. Like, I think sometimes people try to actually enforce that sort of artist shame in themselves because they figure the only real artists hate their own work. And so I always try to encourage that that doesn't have to be the case. And sometimes
it's a great self-defense mechanism. If you can put it out there that you wish that it had been better, then, you know, everybody's quick to say, no, it's amazing. It's amazing.
Oh,
I think a lot of artists use that as
like
sort of shelter.
Yeah.
Well, Amy, your perspective and storytelling series on your Tumblr was amazing.
Thank you.
Seriously, any of our listeners, if you're interested in how panel layout affects the story and like why an artist makes the choices that she does at different points, like, I can't recommend Amy's series any higher. I'll put a link up on the Comics Therapy site if you haven't seen it before. So that, I just wanted to mention that because it's really just going back to what we were talking about before about me being a visual learner. it's a wonderful breakdown of the way that perspective and storytelling go hand in hand. So looking at Rocket Girl specifically, how does the panel layout process like come about? I mean, you just said that you're thumbnailing. So it seems like it might be sort of organic, but like what kind of specific outlines about the layout do you get from Brandon? And like, how does that then evolve into the finished panel design?
From Brandon, it's a pretty typical script in the sense that, like, he's not normally giving me angles and stuff, although sometimes he will, like, if it's something that's over the shoulder or, you know, from behind them or, you know, stuff like that, he might put something in. But yeah, basically I have to figure out from the script, how to make things really clear, one thing that's really hard for me is figuring out which panels they think matter the most, because somehow I always default that they all matter the same amount, and that's not good. So yeah, like stuff like that. And I just basically, I try to become as fluent with the script as possible so that it feels like it's coming from my brain so that I can just suddenly picture it. Like, that's really important. Yeah, so I don't know. I just try and picture it and also feel it, because I find that if I can feel it and if I can picture it, then I will stop at nothing when I'm drawing it until I can get that feeling when I look at it and that other people are going to get that same interpretation. So, I mean, I guess it's kind of like, I don't really have a really good way of explaining it, except that huge perspective and storytelling series where I talk about all the different angles you can use and for what reasons.
That's awesome. Sending people to go see the perspective and storytelling series, because it's such a clear way of looking at it.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's like being able to use those perspective grids, which you'd see if you saw, like, I used digital perspective grids, actually kind of gave me a chance to deduce how I think when I lay things out, which has been helpful for me, but then obviously it makes it really easy to be able to teach that sort of thing. And luckily I have all these files all set up for people to take a look, and I'm like, I did this because this works better this way. So, I don't know. Yeah, you try.
So is that something that has become part of your process? Like, because you have sort of mastered it? So it is now such an organic part of the way that you visualize the script that you're actually like thinking in those perspective grids?
Basically, yeah, because
that's
it's kind of weird. Like, I started using the grids with Fool's Gold, and it was really hard at first, but I totally didn't know how to draw back then. Like, I was seriously a novice at drawing backgrounds and all that stuff. And so, I literally learned how to draw using it. So I kind of, I think in terms of perspective and, you know, vanishing points and stuff like that. It's kind of strange, but it helps. It gives me some structure with which to kind of analyze things.
Right. So it's obvious that you guys now work together pretty seamlessly at this point. And
And we are then reaping the benefits of that as readers. Mm-hmm. So thanks. But that's not always the case in a collaborative medium. Yeah. I'm wondering, I guess, Amy specifically, have you had times in the past working with a writer that were more challenging, especially given your experience right off the bat writing and drawing your own work?
Yeah. Well, I will say that bar none, the easiest thing is to draw for yourself. In my opinion, like, I feel like it's serious brain work trying to lay out somebody else's script. So that in itself is kind of difficult. But luckily the first experience I had was on Madame Xanadu, and Matt Wagner wrote plot first. So that's more of like an open thing where he kind of explains the main things that will happen on each page. And then he creates dialogue afterwards to kind of match it or fill in any blanks that I created. And so that was kind of a nice way to transition into full script. I still really have a hard time with full script. It was really hard to break down J.H. Williams' scripts for sure. So that was kind of a rough one. His scripts are very long. I don't know.
His art is so detail-oriented, too. I wonder, is that how his scripts are?
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. totally, it's like you take that and you turn it into a script.
That's intense.
No, if your process in approaching that is very different from his process, then that can also be a source of friction just in the, before you even get to the end point, like the communication yeah. about how you're going to get there can be rough.
Yeah, exactly. It can cause problems. And he actually literally said, like, he only knows how to picture it first and then kind of break it down from there. That's the only way that he knows that it would work. So, but yeah, I'm such a different artist that I would have to try to kind of interpret that and figure out what he's saying from this and what the general idea is and try and make it something that I can do well. So it was kind of hard. And I think after that, I definitely wanted to, work with somebody that I knew, you know, was interested in how I wanted to work and everything like that.
Yeah, I mean, listen, something that never gets talked about, and it's 100% beneficial and true in my experience, is that, you know, you work with people you like to work with, and it makes the work better, and it makes the finished product better. And it's like, there's something like, oh, you're a professional, so just give, you know, this person's a professional writer, and this person's a professional artist, and you're working for a professional publisher, and everyone's going to do their job. I mean, it's just, you're sitting in your room all day drawing one panel or drawing five panels if you're super fast, or you're writing and you're laboring, you know, in your garage out back or something. It's not a regular job making comics. You have to be invested with the people that you're working with. Otherwise, you're either going to get where you don't care and you kind of half-ass it, and some people can do that. But some people, when they don't care, it drives them absolutely crazy, and I can tell you, and I don't think Amy's going to deny it. Amy's one of those people where it's like,
yeah,
you know,
I can't do something unless I'm mentally there and
yeah, and like so many people are creators. You have to put 100% into it. You can't just say, oh, I'm going to step back. It's only an issue of Batman. I'll get him next month and do something else. It's not like it's an ego where you're fighting over something and you're a prima donna, but you just, as an editor, you learn about artists and writers and all the different kinds of people. And
well, because even though it's maybe thought of from a corporate sense as we're producing a product, you know, this is a corporation. It's not. You're producing art ultimately, and art involves.
It's an inherently creative medium, and there's no way to get around the creative personalities involved with it.
And it's so. I find it so important, and it's going to sound obvious and cliche. You have to work with people you can work with. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You don't have to be
really
best
important.
Friends. You don't have to do. I mean, some people are. Like, you'll never see Brian Azzarello and Jill Thompson work together, and they're married, you know what I mean? That's the last thing they want to do, but they work with people, you know, Azzarello works with, you know,
Cliff Chang.
He works with Cliff Chang, he works with just about one editor most of the time, you know, he finds somebody he wants to work with, he works with again and again and again, and you see these collaborations all the time, Frank Quitely and Grant Morrison, you know what I mean? Or all these different types of things.
You don't want to let go of it.
Yeah, exactly. But it's also because it's like you're doing this every day. And do I really just want to get a script from somebody who's not you know, either not respecting me or not caring about my contributions or just is off doing five other projects and this is just one and they don't care about it. I mean, you know, some people can work like that. Some people can just kind of shut out the world and work on what's in front of them. But so many people need to be, I mean, to reduce it, you need to work with some people who are friends, you know what I mean? And it makes a big difference.
Does it helps or maybe not help? Is there value though in having a contentious relationship sometimes to produce art that or work that you normally wouldn't do? You know, so what I mean is like you're drawing a script from somebody who you find to be difficult to interpret. But but that forces you to kind of work outside your comfort zones too. I mean, is it just too much, or is there a growth value in something like that?
Oh, I think it totally depends on the collaboration. I think it could happen. I know that with Matt Wagner, like he knew that he was giving me new stuff to draw constantly and a lot of challenges. But
he was 100% supportive in everything.
Yeah, there's a difference between challenging and contentious. And so I think contentious is never good in any collaboration. Yeah. It doesn't
unless for
matter.
Some reason everybody, yeah, unless if everybody thrives on that kind
yeah,
of.
Yeah,
you know
I guess
I mean?
It depends on the type of person too. One thing that I've kind of realized is I'm just not one of those people who can muscle through things. And that's, if I were, I might still be at DC, you know? So, it's like, I gotta be happy. And luckily I improve way easier if people leave me alone and I get to have control over things. Luckily that's the case. And I'm not just like making that up or whatever.
Well, true, because everybody thinks that, but it's not
always
true.
A lot of people do think that, but yeah, luckily I've found it to actually be true. So it's interesting because the number one important thing I've found when I'm making comics is to be mentally there and emotionally okay. And that's like paramount to being able to do anything. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of nice. It's kind of nice that because of my job, I have to make sure that I'm happy. That's part of me being a responsible human being is being happy. So it's kind of cool.
Well, since this is, you know, comics therapy, can we talk about your childhood for a moment?
Oh, yeah, let's go for it.
Okay, so for both of you, what kind of comics or art did you gravitate to as a child? You know, so I guess let's start with you, Amy, first. Like, did you read comics as a kid? Like, is there anything you can point to as being really instrumental in developing your personal style?
Oh, sure. I definitely didn't read comics. I was very much, at the time when I was a kid, I always felt like certain things were for boys and certain things were for girls, and I would only wear skirts, and I was like a little resistant to the Ninja Turtles because they were for boys until I realized they were pretty cool. what I was really into when I was young was cartoons. I've always been really interested in the two-dimensional arena. Like, I wouldn't watch anything unless it was a drawing of something. So, I refused to. I hated Sesame Street. I think because of that, and because I was born in 1980, so there were a lot of 80s cartoons I would watch, and a lot of those were farmed out to Japan.
Oh, yeah.
So it was like one of those things where, like, I didn't realize what I was looking at, and it kind of became part of my own culture, not realizing it. Like, that whole, I guess, manga aesthetic of things just kind of got fed to me without me knowing it. And there was also this cartoon that affected me a lot called Unico, that was from Japan that was...
That's
really
the Tezuka adaptation.
Yeah, yeah. I saw both of the movies, and now I own them both because I had them memorized. But, yeah, I think those influenced me a lot. And besides that, it's just, that's really it. I don't know. I guess that in reality and things that I think are pretty. But I saw a lot of cartoons.
No, I could see that being, so that was sort of the gateway to manga. Like, did you read a lot of manga then later on?
I got into manga later on, but it was, it was Sailor Moon first, and that was sort of like really eye opening because it felt like
this was in college.
It was in late high school.
Okay.
It was like a big eye opener because again, it felt like coming home to something. Like it felt so nostalgic to me because of this childhood of watching the Littles and She-Ra and David the Gnome and all these things that were animated by Japanese animators. So
no Voltron or Robotech,
you know, not so much. They were usually like the American cartoons that were drawn by Japanese people.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like
David the Gnome. Wow.
Yeah,
wow. That's from like the vault. I can picture it immediately as soon as you said it, but I haven't thought about it in I'm 34, so like I think that we probably watched most of the same cartoons, so
probably, yeah.
That's awesome.
So yeah, I don't know, I mean like that whole aesthetic was a thing back then, so
yeah.
So yeah, I don't know,
Mysterious Cities of Gold, do you remember that one? Mysterious Cities of Gold.
No, I don't know what that is. I'm gonna
you gotta find it. I'll send you a link to the theme song, because if anything triggers a memory, the theme song will. It's good stuff.
Oh, awesome. Yes, please do. So yeah, I don't know. I guess I was very affected by that. And I remember when I was in third grade, like we were supposed to do career fair or something and interview somebody. And my mom did it for me, you know. I never got to talk to the person. She just called. I told her I wanted to be an animator, and she was having a hard time finding somebody to talk to. But she found a freelance animator, apparently.
Do you think she actually didn't find anybody and was just talking to like the air? Like, oh, I talked to them. This is what you have to do.
So then
you have to listen to your parents.
She wrote down all this information that I had to present later on, and it totally discouraged me from being an animator because it just sounded like it was like 10 to 12 hours of work per day, and you just keep drawing the same thing over and over again. And I was like, this sucks. Yeah, I don't know. But I was very much into animation.
Huh. So what about you, Brandon? You know, I'm sure it sounds like comics are kind of baked into your DNA, at least from high school, but I'm assuming even before then.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Always. They're always around. I have two older brothers. So like I was saying, it's kind of like, to me, it's like comics are wrapped up with like everything from that culture, you know, because it was... You know, I guess by the time Return of the Jedi was out, that was kind of the movie I can remember seeing in a theater. But, you know, playing with Star Wars toys, except Voltron, He-Man, stuff like that, that was all pretty cool stuff. But comics were always around, you know. I always had them in the house. And by the time, like, you know, I was collecting comics pretty early, too. I mean, it must have been, you know, because there were some shops growing up around New York that you could go to. But like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, right? By the time it was on TV, it was already like, no, that's not cool because they've watered it down so much. You know, like a contrary eighth grader or something like that or whatever,
right?
However old I was. And it's like, yeah, because I remember when they were like, no, they would be like all mutants and killing, you know, ninjas in the sewers. And that was kind of...
Oh, right. Like the Eastman, the original run is not at all like the cartoon. Yeah.
Because I was reading and the collector's world was kind of, you know, much more part of comics back then. Now, for good and bad, one of the good things was is that, you know, you there was a kind of, you know, there was no Newsarama, but there was, you know, there was buzz around. You could talk to people, what's the cool comics to read and everything else like that. And I'd have access to a lot of older things, you know, like I had older brothers. So like Planet of the Apes was definitely before my time, or even except like early Star Wars and whatnot. But or Shogun Warriors, I always wished I had, but they were actually before my time. But there was also that kind of nostalgia to stuff, too, because I would dig through quarter bins to find Starlin Captain Marvels, right, or to find old creepy and eerie things. So so not just reading the new comics on the shelf from, like, 1984 or whenever I had started, but also older and newer things, you know, always. And some of my favorites, like Savage Sword of Conan, I really like to read. But I like to read Gru just as much. So it was, you know.
But so... So you say from a collector standpoint, were you that kid who had the long boxes and went for to have every one of the runs and kept things in nice shape, or was it I want to find these so I can read them and I'll read them till they're ragged, or do you have sort of that kind of meticulousness to collecting too?
It's kind of a little bit both. I'm not too meticulous about things. And maybe it's because either the culture was different and I didn't realize it, or I was just naive, right? Because even if I were to buy an old Spider-Man, you know what I mean? Like, I never had a Spider-Man number one or anything big like that. But if I were to buy some old comic, it would be, you know, I would read it and then I would put it in a bag and a board and in the box, right? It wouldn't be something that, you know, had to be, you know, like, say, you know,
right,
perfect and don't touch. I wasn't, you know, and by the time big collecting came out in like the 90s with Image, I was never one to buy two of anything like that, you know what I mean, or something.
Sure.
So, but you could buy a Spider-Man number 20 for 10 bucks in kind of a medium grade, you know what I mean? And I was a collector to the extent that, so in a way I was not that big a collector, but in a way I was a super collector, because when I was 12 years old, I was buying and selling comics at local conventions as a dealer, as a table, you know what I mean? So it was... And I did that from 12 until, you know, my mid-20s. And so in a way, I liked it. And there's a collector's mentality of, but, it, you know, it was pretty atypical. I did what I liked. I was never putting together runs or big issues. But I'd have an interest in something, and I'd want to pick up some. And then my interest would switch, so I'd sell the old and pick up the new.
Okay.
But yeah. It was pretty hardcore, you know?
No, that's awesome. Especially at such a young age to kind of really immerse yourself in that world. I guess maybe it was more accessible. This is in New York.
Correct.
Yeah, so it seems like
he went to San Diego Comic Con a lot of times as a kid, right? Didn't you?
Yeah, because my mother worked for an airline, and you used to be able to fly standby, and I don't think they have that anymore.
Oh.
Right.
But I wasn't 12, but I mean, before I could drive, I was in San Diego, I remember.
Uh-huh.
Because I could get a flight, and because you didn't even need permission. I guess you're a 15-year-old, you can buy a ticket. Isn't that weird? It's not like it was a different era. It was just like, you need an ID number if you're, you know.
But you could show up, buy a ticket, get on the plane.
Yeah, space available, right? So it would be, and back then you could actually go to San Diego and not have to worry about coming back. Mm-hmm. But they all liked me because I was a little kid. So like they'd all like, if there were 10 people waiting for a seat, they would always give it to me.
Mm.
So I did fly to other places in Pittsburgh. There was they used to have a big convention that tied in with all the Night of the Living Dead. I guess they maybe still going on. I don't know. But I guess that was all shot there. So I went there a few times. Yeah.
Well, now that we've talked about childhood, can we talk kind of about the future a little bit?
Yeah. So, nice transition, Aaron.
Thank you. I've been working on that. So in terms of work, can we expect any more like one shots like Halloween Eve, or, you know, have something kind of fun without the trappings of longer, more complex story?
We have thought of, that's a funny question, because like what I was about to say, like, oh, we were thinking of doing maybe some more Halloween Eve, like one a year or something like that. Try and fit it in if we get a chance, but I guess that would make it the trappings of a long story.
No, not necessarily. No, that's a treat every year.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, we don't have anything planned. I know that I personally have.
Yes. From Amy, no. Because, you know, Amy, it's just practically speaking, takes up all your time to do Rocket Girl. Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, like I do have some things that I personally want to do. Like I have two very short web comics. Like or short stories that I want to put on the web that I would be writing, but who knows when I'll get a chance to.
Yeah, I've encouraged Amy, like, so that you should be doing more writing, also, because, you know, Amy doesn't need me. You know, the fact that you're working with me is not out of necessity. You know, you could be doing your own thing at Image. You know, but
I think it's easy to get self-conscious when you've become just an artist, because at first I was writer artist, right? Mm-hmm. So I felt like, you know, I wasn't the greatest, but I could pull it off. And now it's like, it's been so long, I get nervous. But
yeah, but that's what I'm saying. A nice, you know, someone will call up, hey, Amy, do a Red Sonja cover, and you're happy to do it. But you should, you know, think about writing a short Red Sonja, you know, for someone else to draw and get into it.
Yeah, maybe. Know. Maybe.
So it lets you do more than just Rocket Girl. Because the reality is, when Amy's inking and coloring and lettering Rocket Girl, it's like, that's your full-time job. There's not really much time for other things.
Yeah, it is a lot of work.
Is it a possibility that some of that could be passed on to somebody else? I mean, probably not the inking, because I think
that you've described how much that's very much simultaneous with your penciling. But what about, you know, passing off the lettering, for example?
That's possible. Lettering is so fast that it almost feels like I might as well do it. The coloring I've thought about, but I feel like I've been wanting to color myself for so long, I just want to hang on to it for a little while, but sure. Maybe in the future. I know that, like, sometimes I have a hard time letting go of my work for others to work on, but, you know, there's some really great colorists out there, so who knows?
No, and you've had good relationships with colorists in the past. But I know for Amy, it really is true. You can give up coloring tomorrow, but you'd be so nervous about it that you would, you know,
it might slow me down.
It would slow you down. Not in the way that manifests is, okay, I have to pencil it and ink it. I have to do the line work just right. Oh, and I have to leave notes, and I have to, you know, I have to make sure this is separated enough in the line work.
Yeah.
Because a colorist isn't going to notice the different planes and the blah. And then,
right.
you know, wouldn't be as, I guess you'd save some time, but you wouldn't save as much. Right, it would slow down your
Basically, any time that I divide up the tasks, it kind of lengthens them. And so you're right about the penciling and inking, because I'm actually about the same speed or faster when I'm inking my own stuff, because it's so much work to pencil something for somebody else to ink,
right.
And it's a lot of headache too. So,
but it's interesting, Brandon, to hear you say that. Well, it's fantastic that you're encouraging Amy to do some writing. It just reminded me when we talked to Becky Cloonan a couple of weeks or months ago, she was talking about how writing something for somebody else to draw could be kind of liberating and like just a different exercise as a creative individual, because the time constraints are different and it can be, you know, a way of expressing like getting the story out, but maybe with like a little bit more attention to the fact that you're pretty busy with Rocket Girl right now.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think sometimes I'm against the concept of it because I think it's funny that there's writers in comics. It's this weird, like, random belief I have. Much as I love a lot of writers, I just feel like they're the ones that can't draw and they want to read comic books. What's up with that?
Well, I'm sitting right next to you, and I'm not trying to be defensive. And you know, correct me if I'm wrong. I don't think you think that of me. You know what I mean? And I'm not trying to put you on the spot.
I don't.
So if I
present company excluded.
Right.
I just feel like if I'm an artist, I would be a jerk to tell another artist what to do.
Why can't you be the Brandon Montclair and say, well, Brandon brings something to the table and he's supportive and he makes things happen and he puts the artist first. And I'm not saying I'm the perfect writer. You had a good experience with Matt Wagner. Why can't you think of yourself as being the Matt Wagner or being the Brandon Montclair or being the Cecil Castellucci who you like to work with or, you know, these people and saying, oh, I can be supportive. I can give people opportunities. I can, you know, get more of my creativity out there more often, you know?
I might. I think you guys probably convinced me. I'm just saying that's how I usually discourage myself.
You got to break out of those preconceived notions.
That's right. I know. Thanks, you guys, for helping me open up my mind.
You're welcome.
In your comics therapy.
We'll send you the bill.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a lot of fun, Amy and Brandon. We really enjoyed talking to you, and you know, we're going to hold you to this, Amy. Don't worry.
Oh, all right. I'm going to do it.
Do you guys have any last words or recommendations about comics that you're reading right now or anything that you want to share before we head out?
Oh, yeah, we have a couple of things. And by the way, thanks for having us, definitely. But one little thing is we have our own podcast, so we might as well plug it.
Please do.
Yeah, it's called Podcorn. You can find it at podcornpodcast.com. And Brandon and I, we do a weekly thing, comes out on Wednesdays. So you guys should check it out.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and as far as what I'm reading, I'm reading more comics than I normally do these days. And some of my favorites so far have been, well, Saga, but like The Wake, Trillium. Really love, I've been enjoying East of West, and I've,
Black Science, I know you liked.
Oh, yeah, well, I only read the first issue, but it was really awesome. And what about the one that, Kelly Sue DeConnick is doing? Pretty Deadly. Really good. So, there's just so many good comics out. It's actually making me try a lot more things, because I just assume everything is going to be awesome when I try to read it.
Yeah.
Well, especially when it comes to Image, it's a pretty safe bet that anything that comes out is at least worth checking out.
Yeah,
it's a great place to be, and, you know, probably, you know, in a week, they're going to have Image Expo Part 2, right, and stuff that everyone's talking about. And everything that Amy, with the exception of Saga, everything you just mentioned is new, but they've been doing stuff that's kind of ongoing that's really good. Like, I'm one, like, I really like Nowhere Men, you know what I mean?
It's, yeah, I love book. Nowhere Men.
A book that not enough people are reading is Todd the Ugliest Guy. It comes out so sporadically, but it's another great Image book that's been coming out for a while. And, you know, it's like, it kind of gets lost at these things. You know, it's that was kind of like working at DC, right? As soon as your book comes out, well, they're already pitching the next big thing. So you kind of, like, you know, they never let anything have any kind of life of promotion. That's what, you know, you do an interview for Rocket Girl. Oh, what's coming out next? Well, Rocket Girl's only on issue 3. It's like, let's keep talking about Rocket Girl.
Right.
But there's been books that have been coming out that are kind of mid-run that have been really good. You know, Saga gets talked about a lot, or Hawkeye gets talked about a lot. But there's some, you know, there's some newer stuff that's still good, like Todd the Ugliest Kid. Like I was saying, you know, all these Image books are great. And
Well, thanks again to artist Amy Reeder and writer Brandon Montclair for chatting with us today on the couch. Thanks to all of you for listening to another episode of Comics Therapy. Remember to pre-order your print comics, especially creator-owned works like Rocket Girl, and subscribe to them digitally whenever possibly. Show notes are available at comicstherapy.com. I'm going to try to capture everything that was mentioned today by Amy and Brandon, so it's in one place for you guys. And like we said, next week is Image Expo, so we're going to bring you an extra special edition of Comics Therapy, mostly involving Aaron and I actually being in the same place at the same time and not killing each other. It's going to be awesome. As well as a couple of, let's call them, very special guests on the show. So we will see you guys next week.
See you next week.
Until we live in cities you'll never see on screen. Not very pretty, but we sure know how to